Hello, my name is Kent Kleiman. I'm the Dean of the College of Architecture, Art, and Planning. Welcome to the sixth edition of Case Studies in Urban Development. Since 2006, the college has been proud to host a conference founded on the preposterous proposition that once a year we should try to bring together the various disciplines that must in fact work and bump shoulders if they want to have any effect in shaping the built environment after they graduate. Over the years, Case Studies in Urban Development has scrutinized urban projects from London to Seattle to New Songdo to the United States and now to Los Angeles. In each case, we subject an urban fragment to analysis by key practitioners and scholars who bring a broad range of disciplinary perspectives to help us understand more fully the complex choreography of interest, agents, and cultural forces that shape large-scale urban developments. This year, our site is the historic Bunker Hill area of Los Angeles, and specifically the myriad of projects that have occurred or are planning to occur on Grand Avenue, the major boulevard that runs through the former Bunker Hill neighborhood. Grand Avenue and Bunker Hill encompass a sweeping range of thorny urban issues: post-war urban disinvestment and decline, the legacy of so-called slum clearance and its aesthetic biases and social preconceptions, the ever-hot tension between preservation and renewal, and the challenges of creating a vibrant city center in a city famous for being an urban centrifuge. The site, the topics, and the speakers we have here today represent everything the case study program was conceived to encompass, and this will for sure be a revelatory symposium. The symposium has two parts with a hinge in the middle. The first session will focus on the historic context and the motivations that led to the raising of the buildings and the landforms of Bunker Hill. The second session will focus on the contemporary public-private partnership that is developing the site into a mixed-use urban core some 45 years after the last Victorian house was removed from Bunker Hill. Between the two sessions will be a presentation by architect Elizabeth Diller, who is working on a bold cultural vision and building that will become a landmark and a destination on Grand Avenue. Before introducing the first speaker, I want to thank a number of people who made this symposium possible. First, my thanks go for certain to Matt Witte, over there, class of 79, BEARC, who has generously supported each and every Case Study in Urban Development symposium, and who in fact deserves credit for having come up with the idea in the first place. I want to recognize Matt and Lizanne, who are here today. Thank you. Our session moderators are Jeff Chusett, over there, associate professor in planning, and Mark Foster, lecturer in the Baker program, over there, in real estate. And both of you really gave your intellectual leadership to shaping this symposium and giving it its center of gravity, and I thank you for your work on it. Five students representing four disciplines worked tirelessly, and I think it's fair to say collaboratively, at least they're still speaking to one another, to make this symposium and the exhibition upstairs happen. I want to recognize them: Apexa Patel from architecture, Alex Cho from real estate, Martin Romo from planning, and Molly Messer-Smith from art, and Edith Fikes, who's a PhD student in the history of architecture and urban development, all did stellar work, and I thank you on behalf of the college for what you've done. Am I correct that you're still speaking to one another? Is that? Yeah. I want to thank, obviously, all of our guests who traveled great distance to come and be here with us today. It's really an honor to have you here. I know we feel remote. We like to think of ourselves as centrally so, but nonetheless, it's wonderful to have you, and thank you for making the trip. Finally, I want to extend my very hearty thanks to Beth Kunz. All of you who have worked with her know that all threads lead to Beth, and all knots are untied by Beth. And Beth, where are you? I thank you very much for everything you've done for us. Where's Beth? In absentia. And now to our first speaker, Edward Dimmenberg. Ed is a very rare breed of scholar. He is currently professor of film and media studies and professor of visual studies and professor of European languages at UC Irvine. But when I last met Ed, he had a very different set of disciplinary affiliations. He was professor of architecture, film, and German studies at the University of Michigan. And before that, for 8 years, in fact, he was not a professor at all. He was an editor for the UC Press, where he published seminal works by the likes of Rainer Banham, Arthur Danto, and Martin Jay, with whom he co-edited the indispensable, to me indispensable, Weimar Republic sourcebook published in 1994. I learned last night that he now has an additional title, academic consultant, I think it is, a job I quite frankly didn't know existed, and he helps academics across the country write and win grants and fellowships. Not surprisingly, he himself writes exquisitely, and his works include monographs on extraordinary personalities, including the most recent publication on the work of Diller, Scofidio, and Renfro, which he graciously agreed to sign for students today. Ed is a deep, broad, and multi-talented scholar in many areas of humanist thought and study. But if one had to pin it down, I believe his most sustained area of interest might loosely be termed mass media and the built environment. And this is why we asked Ed to open this symposium, since the urban site we are dissecting today is as much a construction of literature, film, and popular culture as it is a physical and social reality. Bunker Hill had been the setting of post-war fictional detective novels and a choice location for more than a few noir films. It serves as an exemplar of the crisis of the late modern city, a topic that Ed has written about and studied deeply and treated with enormous insight in his important book of 2004 titled Film Noir and the Spaces of Modernity. We could not have a better expert to kick off the symposium, so without further delay, please extend a warm welcome to one of our finest intellectual polymaths, Professor Edward Dimmenberg.
Thank you, Kent, for that very generous introduction, and my thanks to you and Lisa for your two decades of friendship. The college is very fortunate to have your leadership and your imagination, and it's really a pleasure to see you and to participate in this event. It's probably impossible to build in any city and not encounter haunted houses and ghost stories. And even if we don't believe in ghosts, perhaps especially if we don't believe in ghosts, they have a habit of turning up and often where one least expect them and when one least expect them. And I would suggest that Bunker Hill is the ghost story of Grand Avenue. I like to think of it as the phantom limb of downtown Los Angeles that many continue to feel, even though it can no longer be seen and as we know, forcibly amputated after the Second World War. It's the neighborhood that probably is most controversial historically, politically, ideologically, and has been read and interpreted in the most diverse ways in the history of the city. Interpretations range from it being widely declared in the 1950s and understood by the urban planning establishment and by the Los Angeles Times as a slum, and more recently having been reinterpreted and valorized by critics such as Mike Davis, who understand it as an Edenic urban paradise in the history of urban LA. And as I think is clear, these interpretations are somewhat extreme, and they suggest to me the difficulty of actually understanding Bunker Hill, trying to understand what it was, what it means for us today in a fashion that's not tendentious. I always turn to Raymond Chandler when I think about Bunker Hill, and I think of this famous description from his 1942 novel, The High Window, that was made into a film under the title The Brasher Doubloon. And this is how Chandler describes the neighborhood then. Bunker Hill is old town, lost town, shabby town, crook town. Once, very long ago, it was the choice residential district of the city, and there are still standing a few of the jigsaw Gothic mansions with wide porches and walls covered with round-end shingles and full-corner bay windows and spindle turrets. They are all rooming houses now. Their parquetry floors are scratched and worn through their once glossy finish, and the wide sweeping staircases are dark with time and cheap varnish laid on over generations of dirt. In the tall rooms, haggard landladies bicker with shifty tenants. On the wide, cool front porches, reaching their cracked shoes into the sun and staring at nothing, sit the old men with faces like lost battles. The general details of the emergence of Bunker Hill as a prime residential district in the 19th century, its subsequent abandonment by wealthy Angelenos as other neighborhoods became more attractive and as automobility changed the face of Los Angeles, are fairly well known. Yet what I find interesting is that there has never been a history of Bunker Hill. No one has written such a book yet. Some years ago, when I was writing my book on film noir and urban space and trying to research Bunker Hill, I came up against a brick wall when I discovered that the police and fire records of the post-war period had been lost in a fire that devastated the records of the Los Angeles Public Library. So even in the archival record, Bunker Hill is in some way, not entirely, but I would suggest substantially associated with absence. And what I want to do is look at some images, both still and moving, and think about them as a way of approaching the problem of understanding Bunker Hill and its representations. This is a photograph by Leonard Nadel, who was the sole photographer for the Los Angeles Housing Authority from 1949 to 1952. And he was famous for making images such as this one, which portrayed downtown Los Angeles. You see Bunker Hill off in the distance in what I would call a documentary, sober, neutral, perhaps WPA style of photography. One rarely, if ever, sees a Nadel photograph made at night. There's always a lot of context in his images, and there's a documentary aspiration to them. People have sometimes compared his work to that of Jacob Riis. Here you see an initial moment of the Bunker Hill redevelopment. Here, a house. And what's striking about Nadel's photography to me, the images of Bunker Hill, is how he tends not to romanticize the architecture and not to romanticize this moment in the history of Los Angeles. One is very clearly aware that many of the houses at the time he made these photographs in the late 40s, early 1950s, were already in quite bad physical shape. And one recognizes that the default condition of Bunker Hill was probably for many of these houses to be torn down and for many of the aging residents to die. It was not a neighborhood, I think one has to note, at the end of the 1940s and 1950s when the redevelopment began under the aegis of the Urban Renewal Program that was evident in Los Angeles and had analogs in many American cities. It was not a city, or it's not an area in the city that I think was particularly stable. It's interesting to contrast Leonard Nadel's photographs with that of a much more atmospheric photographer. known only to scholars who've worked on Bunker Hill history, not yet a household name. And this is Theodore Seymour Hall, who lived on Bunker Hill, unlike Nadell, and who made a series of photographs that record its landmarks and record the redevelopment of the neighborhood. As you can read in this statement, this rather charming credo of the photographer, Hall was quite self-conscious about what he was doing. He photographed everything in the neighborhood, and many of his images have a modernist, self-reflexive quality to them, and they have a much more noir quality as well. This is Angel's Flight. And unlike Nadell, Hall frequently photographed Bunker Hill at night. Probably his most famous image of Angel's Flight. And what I hope to suggest to you by contrasting these two photographers is that there's a rhetoric of Bunker Hill visual representations, and the approaches that photographers take vary quite a bit, and the choices they make as far as the distance from what they photograph, the perspective, the shape, the types of lenses they use, very much affect the type of impression their photographs make upon us. And it's possible, I think, if you look through the photographic corpus of images of Bunker Hill, which is in fact quite large, and there are a number of photographers one could study, and this is really a project that I hope someone one day does, it would be a great dissertation, to look at the different photographers of Bunker Hill and try to think about the different visual strategies they employ and the quite different meanings that their photographs can convey. But Bunker Hill was also a subject for visual artists. This is a 1931 painting, probably the most famous of paintings of Bunker Hill by Millard Sheets, called Angel's Flight. And I'm always struck by how the two women look as if they've been photoshopped into the painting, kind of inserted into the scene, and how already in 1931, the activity that you see them engaged in is looking, contemplation. So the idea of Bunker Hill as a place to be looked at, contemplated, is already present at a very early moment in the history of the neighborhood. And although this painting is called Angel's Flight, we don't actually see the funicular in it. Instead, we look at a number of buildings and tenements from an elevated perspective. And I've been struck thinking about Bunker Hill photographs, especially ones such as Hall's, by the extent to which Angel's Flight, this funicular built early in the 20th century, serves very much the function that the photographic critic, the famous French intellectual Roland Barthes, once described as what he called the punctum of every photograph. And by this, Barthes meant that every photographic image has an element that pierces the viewer, that engages the viewer without being able to be translated into some type of symbolic intellectual system that engages the viewer in a very visceral way. And it seems to me that if one thinks about the imagery of Bunker Hill, Angel's Flight is really the punctum of the neighborhood. The photographs and films that one so often sees of Bunker Hill return to this funicular, which of course exists today. It was moved at some point after the redevelopment of Grand Avenue was finally finished, and I think it's no longer in operation. There were some problems. Someone was killed, actually, in the new location. So the last time I looked, it was shut down. But you can still visit and get a sense of what the funicular looks like. And it's interesting to me and very suggestive to try to imagine what Bunker Hill would be like without Angel's Flight. And to try to imagine the type of visual impact and force it would have without this, its most famous landmark. And to a large extent, I think representations of this neighborhood are governed by what I would call the logic of the snippet. That is to say, one sees a house here, a street there, a corner, Angel's Flight, but one never really has a sense of the larger neighborhood. One really never really has the sense of a larger whole. And Bunker Hill, as the students who worked on this very exciting exhibition, which presented a whole series of films that I never knew about, so congratulations on the excellent research you accomplished. But what the students, I think, can attest to is that Bunker Hill turns up very often in film noir of the 1940s and 1950s. And I think quite generally in this manner of the logic of the snippet that I've been describing. And the one filmmaker, to my mind, who really has managed to work in the post-war period in a different way was Kent McKenzie, who's most famous for making a film that he finished in 1961 called The Exiles. That's about a group of Native Americans who live on Bunker Hill. But before this, he made a film in 1956 that was his diploma project, his thesis project at the University of Southern California School of Film. So what I'd like to do now is watch this film. It's about 17 minutes long, and I think it's quite different from all of the other cinematic representations of Bunker Hill that one sees in film noir. So let's watch this 1956 documentary.
Close to the city center in downtown Los Angeles is a small residential area known as Bunker Hill. The Community Redevelopment Agency, a city agency created to clear slums, has selected Bunker Hill for a multi-million dollar redevelopment project. The Community Redevelopment Agency hopes to condemn and buy all the property from the present owners, to move the 8,000 residents out, to demolish the buildings, and then to sell the cleared land to individuals and corporations who can afford to build in accordance with the agency's master plan. This plan calls for modern office and apartment buildings. The words and voices in the following film are those of people from the Hill, a druggist, and a carpenter, and a doctor.
Well, Bunker Hill is, I'd say, on the fringe of the downtown area. It's a residential section, and it's located on a hill, probably the highest hill within the city.
Originally, if you go back 50 years or more ago, this was the finest residential area of Los Angeles. The finest families lived up here. And then the city grew and changed localities, and everybody pushed out to the suburbs. And these buildings were neglected, and a lot of them were just left alone, and they got in the condition they're in now. And now the income of the people living up here has changed drastically. We have a lot of pensioners up here.
They don't make too much money. And the accommodations that they can afford are here. So a pension allows them to live as the place stands today. With a few improvements wouldn't hurt here and there. Well, on Third Street, there's probably every business that could go well with any small community, any small town. You could name it, and we've got it. And, well, they're all about maybe 10 or 15 or 20 years on the hill. People do live here longer, and consequently get time to get acquainted together and talk and do things together. And people up here find that people aren't so bad after they get acquainted with them. And it has solved the problem of a big city where you can live there for 200 years and you're still nobody. But up on Bunker Hill, people are somebody. They like it here. It's a kind of a small town atmosphere, and they enjoy themselves, and they like to feel that they're in the presence of friends and acquaintances, and they get to meet people, and these people give them a sense of belonging and a sense of importance and a feeling of friendship and comradeship, and that's important in living too. A lot of them have been here quite a while, and I think they'd like to stay here. A laundry, a dry cleaning establishment, three or four in fact, radio shop, television place, grocery stores, cafes, bars, liquor store, and he's a pretty good shoemaker. He will make almost any kind of a shoe that you can draw a picture of, I believe, with or without buttons. Every 10 years, it seems that somebody comes up with a scheme to demolish Bunker Hill.
They really had an equitable plan for the benefit of the majority. They would come up with an idea to rehabilitate this area and let the same inhabitants that live here now stay here. Instead of actually improving and clearing the slums, they want to do away with everything, including the Class A and good solid buildings up here. Their method of going about it is to not only clear the slums, but clear all the people out of the area and re-beautify the whole thing, rebuild it, put an opera house up here, make a picture area out of it without keeping the inhabitants in mind at all.
I am known as the poor doctor for the sick poor and the poor sick. Most of my people are old people, between 60 and 90 years of age. I call them my people because they think they are my people, and they call themselves my people. They only have their pensions, and they can't afford to pay more than they do pay. And I've stood good for them many, many times when they haven't had the means. That's the reason that it would break me up mentally, I think, almost, to have to leave them, because many of them depend so much on me. For little things that are not counted very much by other people. My daughter won today. She said, "Doctor, I hope you won't die before I do. I hope you don't die before me." Well, I'm a rich man in this way, a rich man in having many, many poor friends. They're living in dread of the day they're going to be kicked out. Of course, if they all went, I'd have to go some other place. But I'm getting too old now to start a new practice. I minimize my practice as much as I can, but I don't neglect my people. I wouldn't know how to go to them. They'd be scattered so far away like scattered sheep. Oh, they'd find some doctor, perhaps. Or have to have the county take care of them, and that they don't want. They're too proud. But they're entitled to the old age pension. They're entitled to the kindnesses that should go with it. And I've been trying for 30 years to give it to them.
It seems like most of the old folks I've talked to about the problem of moving have always felt that if they figured something out for them, that is the government, it'd be an old folks' home under a different name. And one of the things that most of the older folks around here like to do, that I've noticed, is that they like to feel that they're part of the business of living. They stand around on big construction jobs, and they like to watch this big scoop shovel tearing away at the earth, and they like to see the big machines pulling and pulling and grunting back and forth, and they like to watch the progress of all this work. And they get the feeling of still being a part of the business of living and working, and that's good for them. Mostly they just sit down on a park bench up here on Bunker Hill Street, and they sit and talk, and some of them play checkers, some of them just sit, some of them read a newspaper. And some will walk along and talk to each other, some will sweep the sidewalk and stop to chat with people going by, and somebody will mow the lawn or have a dog, and they'll stop and talk, and they're not moving too fast, and almost anybody can catch up with them. Well, there's a wide assortment of views. All you have to do to get the cross-section of the views on Bunker Hill is to stop to people and talk to them, ask them about this or that. And they'll talk to you. First names, last names, ain't important. These people follow their hobbies and notions, and they may not push them too strong, but when they take a notion they want to do it, they do it. And that's important for people. I've heard say that they have some plans to take care of these old people, but
they have not shown up yet, any plan. What to do with them? They can't move them in the east of town because that's where the slums are. And they can't move them further west because they haven't got the means to pay the rent. And they can't put them in dormitories. They want to be independent, as they have been all their lives. They're deserving of it. They should be entitled to it. It's hardly probable that they'd ever find another Bunker Hill anywhere. For the most part, they'd probably be scattered all over the city, and they would have lost a sense of community, a sense of belonging somewhere, and being happy there.
However, this modernistic, futuristic city that some of these visionaries have thought of, it sounds wonderful on paper, but in the realistic world, I think that the human element ought to be thought of first, rather than the monetary gain, and the old people ought to be given preference over beautiful structures. What every major city today needs is suitable homes for these old age pensioners. Medium and low price housing. You don't have to worry about people with higher incomes. You have to worry about the low income group and the destitute and the pensioner and people of that type, and you've got to take care of them.
Kent McKenzie, I think, over the past 10 years has become recognized as the great film auteur of Los Angeles of the 1950s and 1960s, someone who clearly studied Italian neorealism very carefully and was able to make films about Bunker Hill with great sensitivity and empathy for the people living in the neighborhood. Clearly, this is what one might call a contrarian view if you look at most of the films made about Bunker Hill in the 1950s. They're much less sympathetic and suggest that the neighborhood was by no means as benign as Mackenzie suggests. What can one take away from all of this? What can one conclude from these images that I've shown you this afternoon? I want to make a couple of suggestions. And the first is that we recognize that every image of Bunker Hill, every representation of this neighborhood, has some type of agenda. It always comes loaded with the project. And it's impossible to represent this this part of the city without at the same time advocating some type of project. I also want to suggest that we acknowledge the typicality of Bunker Hill, the extent to which its history and eventual destruction resemble the histories and eventual destruction of so many other neighborhoods and so many other American cities, and the extent to which this story is not atypical and tells us so much about the failures of American planning and redevelopment in the 20th century. And I think it would be very useful to study Bunker Hill and other urban renewal histories sociologically rather than historically. And that is to say, focus not primarily upon their unique features, but the extent to which the interaction between different constituents and stakeholders, residents, developers, politicians, and other elites has a certain determinate structure. And I think it would be useful to try to understand these episodes using the methodologies of the social sciences. I also want to suggest that we temper our nostalgia for Bunker Hill and recognize that as compelling and different as it appears to us today from contemporary cities, the cities in which we live and work, it also had serious problems and limitations and was by no means perfect. And it's very easy to obtain a different impression watching a film such as Mackenzie's. I also want to suggest that we look for Bunker Hill in other neighborhoods in Los Angeles, that if you want a sense of what Bunker Hill was like, all you really need to do is get in your car and drive 15 minutes away from downtown, and you can find Boyle Heights, you can find neighborhoods northwest of downtown, you can find parts of Silver Lake that have some of the same architecture and some of the same topography as Bunker Hill. So it really isn't that difficult to imagine what the neighborhood was like. All you have to do is look at different sections of Los Angeles today, which in many ways and in many neighborhoods still resemble this section of the city that was destroyed. Finally, I want to suggest that we learn from the mistakes in the planning process and the politicization of Bunker Hill and try to recognize that even though this was an imperfect process and the planning process today is obviously very different in the 21st century, that the aspiration to make a better city and to make a more livable city is one that we shouldn't abandon. We shouldn't conclude because mistakes were made and ideal and best practices weren't followed that urban planning and urban redevelopment are not worth pursuing. So thank you very much.